Good morning. Peace and greetings to all. Thank you, Reza, for that introduction. I also want to express my delight in being here, attending yet another Building Bridges seminar, and I want to express my fervent gratitude to the Most Reverend Archbishop of Canterbury, Norman Williams, and his efficient and excellent staff for organizing this event. Thank you. For the purposes of this presentation, I'm defining the Islamic tradition as consisting of extra Quranic sources, the Hadith corpus containing the statements of the Prophet Muhammad, the tafsir or exegetical works, and ethical or edifying literature which provides moral counsel and guidance for the educated Muslim. Since these genres include a prodigious amount of material, and it would be impossible to do full justice to it, I will restrict my discussion to select primary sources and attempt to provide a broad overview of some of the major themes included under the topics of death, resurrection, and human destiny, in particular the pre-modern literature. The constant remembrance of death is a frequent topos in Islamic edifying literature and pious works in general. The well-known figure of piety and abstemiousness from the 8th century, Abdullah ibn Mubarak, wrote a treatise entitled in Arabic, Kitab al-Zuhud. Zuhud is a notoriously difficult word to translate pithily into English. Variously rendered as piety, abstemiousness, and God-consciousness, Zuhud is all this and more. It is above all a moral and ethical imperative that encourages the believer to live his or her life in this world as a preparation for the more glorious life in the presence of the Almighty in the next. The pious abstemious person realizes that death is both the joyous gateway to the hereafter and the sober reminder of the true purpose of our earthly life, which heightens our spiritual awareness and God consciousness. Ibn Mubarak records a report from the famous companion Abdullah ibn Abbas, who counseled, and I'm going to quote from him, "If you should see a man close to death, give him good tidings, so that he may meet his Lord with a happy disposition. But while he lives, awake in him fearful reverence for his Lord, the mighty and exalted." Another early pious figure, the jurist Nu'aym ibn Hammad from the 9th century, emphasizes that the preparation for our eternal life in the next world revolves around constant remembrance of death, which protects us from the useless distractions of life. He cites a hadith in which the prophet remarks, "Increase your remembrance of that which extinguishes worldly frivolities, that is to say, death." Death is a sober reminder that our worldly possessions and friendships do not travel with us into the next world. In another hadith, the prophet is quoted as observing, "Three things follow the deceased, two of them return, and only one remains, his family, wealth, and actions follow him. However, his family and wealth come back, and only his deeds remain." End quote. Appreciation of the fleeting nature of our worldly attachments enhances our awareness of death and the eventual meeting with our Creator. Even though in our modern, somewhat deracinated world, reflection on death is regarded as rather morbid and unhealthy, the great Muslim scholars, like their Christian counterparts, saw such contemplative practices as nurturing one's inner spiritual life and the pathway to true wisdom and happiness. The famous Muslim mystic and theologian Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, who died in 1111, easy year to remember, addresses the student of the mysteries of God in the following manner. "Know, beloved, that we cannot understand the future world until we know what death is. A And we cannot know what death is until we know what life is. Nor can we understand what life is until we know what the spirit is. Unless any further remarks that not all of the things and accoutrements of this world are blameworthy. Rather, happiness consists in finding pleasure in the right things and the right attributes, because they lead to happiness in the next world. Thus he says, and I'm going to quote from him at some length now, delight in knowledge, delight in worship, delight in prayer, and delight in communion with God are things of this world. But still, they are for the sake of the future world. It follows, therefore, that the pleasures of the world are not all of them blameable, but only those which entail punishment in the future world, or which are not in the path to paradise. And so the apostle declares, the world is a curse, and that which is in it is a curse, except the remembrance of God and that which is the object of his love. End quote. Moving on now to a discussion of death and the grave, pondering its mysteries. What specifically happens at the time of death, in the grave, and during the resurrection, are topics that find scanty reference in the Quran itself, in the Hadith, exegetical literature, and edifying pious works, however, occasionally provide us with details about such matters. Once again, it is Al-Ghazali who describes for us the process of the soul departing from the human body. The soul, he says, is attended by four angels who announce to the dying person that they have been responsible for his food, his drink, his breath, and his term of life, all of which was now coming to an end. While death in general is an agonizing experience for the human being, Al-Ghazali comments, the good soul slips out like the jetting of water from a water skin, but the profligate spirit squeaks out like a skewer from wet wool. By the way, that is not my translation, but I think it's pretty good. It's very popular. An anonymous work titled Book of the Circumstances of the Resurrection provides graphic descriptions of the momentousness of death and its terrifying aspects. The angel of death, called Ezra'il, appears in an awe-inspiring form to the dying person. When the latter asks, who are you? The angel of death answers, I am the angel of death, who makes your children orphans and wife a widow. When the soul of the pious individual slips out, two or four angels clad in white garments and with faces gleaming like the sun approach it, bearing clothes and sweet-smelling embalming fluid with which to wrap it. In some accounts, it is the angel Gabriel who accompanies the ascending soul. The trip to the highest level of paradise mirrors the Prophet Muhammad's night journey, for at each level, the ascending soul encounters bygone communities. Finally, the soul and its angelic escorts reach the highest pavilions and the heavenly low tree, known in Arabic as the Sidra al-Muntaha, the level that is the closest to God. Here the Almighty welcomes the righteous soul briefly, commands the angel to inscribe his or her name in the heavenly registers, and returns the soul to the body. Fewer details are available concerning the unrighteous individual. Al-Ghazali says that in such a case, the angel of death will deliver the evil soul to the guardians of hell, who clothe it in a hair shirt. The angel supervising these guardians is called Dakyaini, who attempts, like Gabriel, to rise through the heavenly layers of the soul, but is prevented from doing so. Dakyaini then casts away the soul, and it returns to the body. All of these events are described as happening so quickly that the soul returns to the body while it is still being prepared for burial. Islamic tradition maintains that the deceased, once placed in the grave, is visited by two angels, Munkar and Nakir, as we heard earlier this morning, who ask questions about the person's faith. These angels are not mentioned in the Quran, but in the popular tradition, they have become an almost ubiquitous feature of posthumous life in the grave. Their interrogation represents a preliminary assessment of an individual's worldly record of faith and deeds before the day of resurrection and the final, definitive divine judgment on that day. The tradition also informs us that the faithful will be spared the pressure of the grave, which, however, afflicts the wrongdoers. Typically, accounts of the ordeals in the grave are tempered by reminders of God's mercy and forgiveness, so as to instill hope in the reader. The tradition never came to recognize an intermediate stage between death and resurrection, termed barzakh, that very broadly corresponds to the Catholic notion of purgatory. The term is used in the Quran primarily in the sense of an obstacle, either a moral or a concrete one, which in the exegetical and eschatological literature becomes reinterpreted as a physical barrier between this world and the next, or that between the grave and the hereafter. As the equivalent of purgatory, barzakh is the intermediate world where the soul through suffering can earn partial expiation for its sins. The Quranic concept of the Araf in Quran 746, usually translated as the heights, presented another challenge to the interpreters, and may be usefully compared to the Christian concept of limbo. This verse suggests a third realm inhabited by souls who have completed the judgment process, but have not been deemed suited fully either for heaven or for hell. A majority of the exegetes are of the opinion that the state of abeyance is earned by those whose good deeds exactly balance their bad deeds. Extra Quranic sources state that after the divine judgment, both the saved and the condemned will have to cross a bridge, Sina. The righteous cross it easily and swiftly into the promised garden of bliss. The unrighteous find the passage perilous and slippery, and fall off into the abyss of fire. Although the Quran is adamant that each individual is accountable for his or her sins only, and cannot bear the burdens of another, nor intercede for them, the tradition allows for the possibility of intercession by the Prophet Muhammad for his community. The hadith and eschatological literature mention a hawl, or a basin of sweet, delicious water, where the Prophet will meet the members of his community. Other accounts say that he will intercede on behalf of all humanity. All but the most egregiously sinful will be saved from damnation by the Prophet's intercession and God's mercy. With regard to the afterlife, descriptions of paradise and hellfire, once again, compared to the Quran, which has only cursory references to life in the hereafter beyond the grave, the Hadith and Quran commentaries provide a rich topography of the next world, particularly of paradise. Thus, Al-Bukhari, in his famous Hadith compilation, As-Sahih, records a report from the Prophet in which paradise, usually referred to as the garden in Arabic, Al-Jannah, is described as a vast realm which has 8 gates and 100 levels. The highest level of paradise is called Firdaus, directly above which is the throne of God. From this level, the 4 rivers of paradise flow. According to other hadiths recorded by Al-Bukhari and Muslim, the majority of the inhabitants of paradise will come from the ranks of the weak and the poor on earth. One report, and this is among my favorites, states that the best of women will precede the best of men into paradise, as it should be. The paradise dwellers are eternally young and their bodies pure, unsullied by earthly bodily functions. Each man will be as tall as Adam, between 60 to 90 cubits, as old as Jesus, which is 33 years, and as handsome as Joseph. Each woman is about 80 cubits tall and perennially young and beautiful. One report suggests that the paradise dwellers continue to grow in beauty and fairness, and their faces are radiant like the full moon. The dark-eyed celestial houris, who are said to be made of light or saffron, or according to varying accounts, musk, ambergris, and camphor, sing in mellifluous voices. The least fortunate among the inhabitants of paradise is described in some reports as having 1,000 mansions made from pearls, chrysolite, and sapphire, with about 70,000 servants in attendance. As for the provisions in Arabic rizq that the righteous will enjoy in the hereafter, it includes closeness to God, a noble status before Him, and the opportunity to engage in seemly praise of Him. Their souls will exult in the good things of paradise, a state which will be enhanced when eventually reunited with their bodies. Believers praise God day and night with every breath they take, and they are assured of His satisfaction in them. A few reports not found in the standard compilation state that Arabic will be the language of heaven. According to a number of accounts, the ultimate reward for the pious is the beatific vision of God. Clear as the full moon on a cloudless night, as is described in one account. Exactly how this beatific vision will be perceived by the heavenly dwellers has remained a matter of debate among Muslim scholars. The sacred hadith Qudsi, which states that God has prepared for the believer what no eye has seen, no ear has ever heard, nor has been grasped by the human heart, is often cited in this context to signify that the nature of the bounties awaiting the righteous in the next world defies worldly categories and descriptions. This became the prevalent Ash'ari position in accordance with their principle of without asking how, bila kayf. Traditional theologians in general accepted at face value the description of heavenly pleasures contained in hadiths found in the authoritative collections while emphasizing their otherworldly nature. The Mu'tazila, who are usually described as rationalists in English, tended to be more skeptical of such reports and downplayed the hyperbolic imagery conveyed by them. With regard to particularly the beatific vision of God, they rejected that possibility since that would smack of anthropomorphism in their opinion. Now, a brief discussion of the fires of hell as punishment for sinners. Common terms in the Quran for hell are Jahannam, Gehenna, and An-Nar, which simply means the fire, predominant feature of hell. The extra Quranic literature describes the features of hell in some detail. According to one hadith, Jahannam will be brought near on the Day of Judgment, whose 70,000 reins will be dragged by 70,000 angels who constantly stoke its fires. Al-Ghazali identifies seven layers of hell, Jahannam being the worst. The famous mystical philosopher Ibn Arabi describes Satan as both the king of hell and his shackled inhabitant, the image of which is said to have influenced Dante's conception of the imprisoned Lucifer. One report presents heaven and hell arguing with one another about the people who will enter them. Hell says, "All those who are tyrannical and arrogant will enter me," while heaven declares, "All those who are weak and destitute will enter me." Then God addresses them both and says to hell, "You represent my punishment for those I wish to punish, and to heaven, you represent my mercy, which will envelop those I wish to be merciful towards. And each of you will be full." Clearly, this report is meant to assure us that we're ultimately responsible for our actions and personally accountable to God for their consequences. may be posed then at this juncture is, must those who reap the punishment of hell for their wrongdoing on earth remain in it forever? This is a question of perennial interest to humans, for who among us, sinners all, has not feared the tribulations of the next world? One hadith reported by Muslim in his well-known collection, also called As-Sahih, may appear to dash our hopes of gaining eventual redemption in the next world. According to the famous companion Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, the Prophet is said to have remarked, and I quote, "On the day of judgment, death will be brought forward like a spotted ram and placed between heaven and hell. Then a voice will cry out, 'O people of paradise, do you know what this is?' They will crane their necks and gaze at it, and then reply, 'Yes, it is death.' Then a voice will cry out again, 'O people of hellfire, do you know what this is?' They too will crane their necks to scrutinize it and reply, 'Yes, this is death.' Then the command is given that it be slaughtered. Then a voice will cry out again, 'O people of paradise, eternity and no death. And O people of hellfire, eternity and no death.'" The prospect of spending eternity in paradise obviously poses no problems for us. But the prospect of spending eternity in hellfire is, to put it mildly, daunting. Although the hadith I just cited suggests that people will be assigned to the garden or to the fire forever, a majority of Muslim theologians are agreed that the faithful will eventually all emerge from punishment in hell and be transported to heaven. But what about the rest of sinning humanity? Some have found solace in Quran 11:107, which states, "They will abide in it," that is the fire, "as long as the heavens and the earth endure, except for what your Lord wills," which has led to the interpretation that the fires of hell will at some point be completely extinguished. The influential Hanbali jurist Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyya from the 14th century came out strongly in favor of the position that the fires of hell will one day be completely put out. Among the reasons he cited for this position are, first, God so loves to forgive and release those who do wrong that he will do so. Secondly, one cannot equate divine anger with divine mercy. Thirdly, three verses in the Quran, Quran 6:128, 11:107, which I read to you, and 78:23, indicate that the fire will not last forever. And fourth, while the garden as heavenly compensation for one's deeds is an end in itself, the fire is a means of purification. Once humans have been purified of their sins, there would be no need for its existence anymore. So, the question that may be asked is, who are the reapers of the celestial garden? And I'm going to pick up the pace. I've gotten the other 5 minute notice. Since the celestial garden is the promised reward for the faithful, Muslim thinkers pay quite a bit of attention to the nature of the good deeds and the cultivation of moral attributes, which facilitates one's advancement towards it. The three groups mentioned in Quran 4:69, described as obeying God and his messenger, and who thereby earn God's bounty, often provide a point of departure for such discussions, especially among Quran exegetes. In addition to the prophets and Nabiyun, these three groups are the truthful ones, As-Siddiqun, the virtuous, As-Salihun, and the witnesses, As-Shuhada. The famous Quran commentator Ar-Razi inclines to the view that each of these categories is distinctive from the other and describes a specific type of person or group of people. Thus, the term As-Siddiqun is applied to those who are habitually and most notably truthful, a noble and distinctive trait in believers. With regard to the Shuhada, Ar-Razi says that they are those who establish justice, as is further borne out in Quran 3:18. The one killed in the path of God is also a witness, shahid, to the extent that he has exerted himself in aiding the religion of God and borne witness that it is the truth and distinct from falsehood. The shuhada bear witness in this world and the next, as indicated in Quran 2.143. Finally, the salihun in brief are those who are righteous in their belief and in their actions, and they're placed after the shuhada in moral excellence. There is thus a distinct hierarchy of moral excellence adumbrated in this verse, with the prophets at the top and the salihun at the bottom, each learning about religion from the category of people immediately above them. This hierarchy is also replicated in the next world, so that the prophets occupy the highest level of paradise, followed by the truthful ones, then the witnesses, and then the righteous in general. Ar-Razi's observation that the shuhada also include those who bear witness to the truth with their lives brings us to a special category of people in the Islamic tradition who are deemed to be alive even after they are physically dead. This category owes its genesis to two key Quranic verses, one of which states, "Do not say regarding those who are slain in the path of God that they are dead. Rather, they are alive, but you're not aware." This is from Quran 2:154. And the other which states, "Do not consider as dead those who are slain in the path of God. Rather, they are alive and given sustenance in the presence of their Lord." Quran 3:169. Exegeses of these verses have given rise to the exalted status assigned by the tradition to martyrs, especially martyrs who fall on the battlefield in defense of the faith. In the famous exegete of Tabari's discussion of these two verses, we find a detailed archaeology of the next world and an extensive taxonomy of the heavenly rewards awaiting specific categories of believers, indicating the extent to which this issue has begun to exercise the minds of exegetes. He begins by commenting that in Quran 2:154, God addresses the believers and exhorts them to seek his help while patiently obeying him in their striving against their enemies, forsaking all that constitutes disobedience to him, and in carrying out the rest of their religious obligations. They're also commanded not to say, regarding those who are slain in the path of God, that they are dead, minded. For the dead are lifeless and deprived of their senses, unable to enjoy pleasures and experience bliss. Rather, Al-Tabari says, God addresses humanity thus. Those among you and from the rest of my creation who are slain in the path of God are alive in my presence, immersed in life and bliss, enjoying a blissful existence and glorious provisions, exulting in what I have bestowed on them of my bounty and conferred on them of my generosity. End of quote. Al-Tabari quotes the earlier exegete Mujahid ibn Jabr, who understood this verse as referring to those who are alive in the presence of their Lord, enjoying the fruits of heaven, and who smell its fragrance, even though they are not actually within it, that is to say, heaven. Ar-Razi, however, inclines towards the view that the martyrs enjoy the rewards spiritually, for no one will be physically resurrected until the day of judgment, and the disembodied soul is capable of experiencing pain and pleasure. On the day of resurrection, the souls will be united with their bodies, leading to a fusion of the physical states with the spiritual. Before we leave aside the topic of who reaps heavenly compensation, it should be noted that in one Quranic verse in particular, Quran 39:10, a special category of people are indicated who are described as earning God's unlimited approbation in the next world. Despite the fact that this category of people have been singled out for high Quranic praise, they have not received much attention in the general literature. The verse states, "O my servants who believe, fear your Lord. For those who do good in this world is goodness, and God's earth is blind. Indeed, the patient and steadfast ones," in Arabic, as-sabirun, "will be given their reward without measure." The exegetes are practically unanimous in their understanding that the referent in this verse is all those who, in the face of great tribulations and trials, were and are patient and steadfast in their earthly lives. As a consequence, they will be rewarded by admission into paradise and enjoyment of the unlimited provisions within it. For such a group of people, there is no reckoning for them in paradise. A Zamakshari in the 12th century, the monk is in the exegete from the 12th century, similarly notes the high rank of the Sabirun, the patient and steadfast ones in the Quran, who are described as those who patiently bore the pain of separation from their homeland and their kinsfolk and other trials and afflictions on account of their obedience to God and their great virtue. The Prophet himself had remarked, and I'm quoting, "The scales will be raised, and the people of Ans will be brought forward, and their compensations will be given with due measure. Likewise with the people of prayer and pilgrimage. Then the people of trials, that is, the people who underwent trials, will be brought in, and the scales will not be raised for them, nor will their record of deeds be unfurled. Rather, their reward will be heaped upon them without measure." The famous pious scholar Ibn Abi Dunya records a hadith in which the Prophet clearly signals out those who are patient as deserving of exceptional heavenly reward as follows. "When God will gather together creation on the day of judgment, a caller will cry out, 'Where are the people of patient forbearance, Ahim Sabr?' A group of people few in number will rise and hasten towards paradise. The angels will meet them and inquire, 'We see you rushing towards paradise. Who are you?' They will reply, 'We were the people of patient forbearance.' The angels will ask, 'What did your patience consist of?' They will respond, 'We used to patiently persevere in obeying God and were steadfast in not disobeying Him.' Then it will be said to them, 'Enter paradise, the best of recompense for those who have acted well.'" End of quote. This hierarchy of moral excellence is inclusive of all those righteous believers who strive daily in their lives in ordinary and extraordinary ways to fulfill the will of God and to bear witness to His goodness and solicitude for humanity, despite the worldly tribulations that descend upon them. In conclusion, clearly Muslims have been concerned about their life in the next world as much as they have been concerned about their life in this world. The extra Quranic literature gives us a window into how Muslims through the ages have woven together a richly textured tapestry, which records how they have conceptualized life after their earthly existence. Ultimately, these narratives encode for us the fundamental human hope that the mercy of the Almighty will embrace us all, erase all the failings that make us so fallibly human, and allow us to reach our fullest potential in the presence of the divine.